when I started my career, the first thing I said to my record company was, I just want you to know, before we have this meeting, I am not pretending to be straight. I am going to be totally honest about my homosexuality.
Better pray for yourself. Cause the game of science comes.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Illinois bans bias, but other states move against marriage. Israel's top court blesses queer families, but U.S. Supremes stay silent. And Want 2 boosts Rufus Wainwright's openly gay pop music stardom. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending January 15th, 2005. Illinois is about to become the 15th U.S. state to make sexual orientation a category protected from discrimination under its civil rights law. And the category is defined so as to specifically include transgenders. This week, a bill to amend Illinois' Human Rights Act was passed first by the smallest possible majority of the Senate, and then by 56% of the House. Democratic Governor Rod Blagojevich actively lobbied for the bill's passage and said he looks forward to signing it. Illinois' Human Rights Act prohibits discrimination in housing, employment, and lending. The House vote came on the final day of the lame duck outgoing legislature, or it would have had to be reintroduced once the new legislature was sworn in. About three-fourths of House Republicans opposed the bill, while more than four-fifths of Democrats supported it. House opponents cited fears of legal same-gender marriage, cross-dressers using opposite-sex bathrooms, and what one called a much, much bigger agenda. The religious right group Family PAC promised a legal challenge to the amendment. Roman Catholic Cardinal Francis George reportedly personally lobbied Catholic legislators to oppose the bill.
More typical of what's happening in U.S. state legislatures was the approval this week by the Kansas Senate of a proposed constitutional amendment to deny both marriage and its benefits to same-gender couples. Republican Senate leadership held the vote in the first week of the new legislative session, hoping the measure will go on the ballot for elections in early April. That would require House approval in early February, but in the last session, a similar Senate-passed measure failed to win the required two-thirds majority in the House. At least eight other states are expected to consider constitutional amendments to restrict marriage exclusively to a one man and one woman this year.
Florida's ban on adoptions by gays and lesbians will continue after the U.S. Supreme Court this week declined to take up a challenge to it. The Florida law is unique among the United States. It was challenged by the American Civil Liberties Union on behalf of four gay men, but a three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals upheld it a year ago. That ruling will stand with the National High Court's rejection this week, which, as usual, came without comment. Lesbigay activists reacted with dismay, particularly celebrity and adoptive parent Rosie O'Donnell, who identified herself as a lesbian on national TV in her continuing campaign to strike down the Florida ban.
But Israel's Supreme Court this week issued a landmark decision opening second parent adoptions to same-gender partners. Lesbians Tal and Avital Yaros Hakak have been living together for 15 years and in that time have borne three children by artificial insemination using anonymous donors. They've been trying to co-adopt each other's children since 1997. At that time, a family court denied them parental rights, but did give both of them joint legal guardianship of the children, a pioneering move at the time that has since become commonplace. They appealed to a district court, which also denied the adoptions. Now, a 7-2 majority of the Supreme Court has returned their petitions for adoption to the family court, ordering that court to make its determination based on the welfare of the children. However, the women had limited their request, referring to special circumstances and not asking to be recognized as a couple. The Supreme Court similarly limited its finding, declaring in the majority opinion that we are not ruling that a single-sex couple are a man and wife together. The decision to return the case to the family court is not a recognition of the status of the same-sex family unit. Nonetheless, conservative activists and politicians reacted strongly against the decision, primarily on religious grounds. But liberal politicians welcomed it, and the legal advocacy group New Family cheered it as a revolutionary step towards equal treatment of gays and lesbians.
Pope John Paul II this week announced his agenda for the year in his so-called State of the World address to the Vatican's diplomatic corps. And opposition to legal recognition of same-gender couples topped the list. He said, "Today the family is often threatened by social and cultural pressures that tend to undermine its stabilities. But in some countries, the family is also threatened by legislation which, at times directly, challenge its natural structure, which is and must necessarily be that of a union between a man and a woman founded on marriage. Family must never be undermined by laws based on a narrow and unnatural vision of man."
The 77-million-member Global Anglican Communion continues to wrestle with the 2003 consecration of openly partnered gay Gene Robinson as Bishop of New Hampshire. The Global Church's position is that its clergy should have sexual activity only with an opposite-sex marriage partner. This week, the bishops of the U.S. branch, the 2.3 million-member Episcopal Church, responded to the recommendations of a commission appointed by the Archbishop of Canterbury to try to heal the resulting split in the world church. After a two-day closed meeting, the U.S. leaders issued a statement saying, "We as the House of Bishops express our sincere regret for the pain, the hurt, and the damage caused to our Anglican bonds of affection by certain actions of our church. We express this regret as a sign of our deep desire for and commitment to continuation of our partnership in the Anglican Communion." A spokesperson underscored that they were not apologizing for the consecration itself, which was agreed to by sizable majorities of both clergy and laity at a U.S. national synod. In addition, the U.S. bishops were not ready to commit to the moratorium on any further elevations of openly partnered gays and lesbians that the commission had called for. Opponents of Robinson's consecration were not mollified by the U.S. bishop's statement.
The 5-million-member Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is another U.S. denomination that has long been wrestling with gay issues. This week saw the report of a task force the ELCA had set up to study the issue over the last 3 years. Unsurprisingly, the group found what it called deep, pervasive disagreement, but was looking for ways to keep those on both sides in the church. It recommended that the ELCA should continue its current policies against blessing same-gender couples and ordaining sexually active gays and lesbians. However, the task force recommended that the church should not pursue disciplinary actions against ministers or congregations that chose to violate those policies. Task force chair Bishop Margaret Payne said, "I think this is about letting people be responsible to human conscience rather than a capricious decision to let people do what they want to do." The ELCA will be holding its national meeting in August, where any legislative decisions would be made.
The 8.3 million-member United Methodist Church last month defrocked openly partnered lesbian minister Irene Stroud of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, for violating its similar policy against ordination of what it calls self-avowed practicing homosexuals. Stroud has appealed that church court ruling to the church's regional appeals panel for the 12-state northeastern jurisdiction. A key element in her appeal is testimony from six of her witnesses that her Eastern Pennsylvania Conference trial court refused to hear.
Germany was shocked this week by the murder in Munich of openly gay celebrity fashion designer Rudolf Mosshammer, known as Mossi. He had immense success over more than 35 years of designing men's clothing. His clients, including Sweden's King Carl Gustaf XVI, tenor José Carreras, entertainers Siegfried and Roy, and film star cum California governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was notably charitable both as a major donor and as an active fundraiser, but he always drew the public eye with his personal eccentricities, which included always appearing in public in makeup and a bouffant wig accompanied by his Yorkshire Terrier. Among those offering tributes was Premier of Bavaria Edmund Stoiber, who said, "He was an original, and he had a big heart." Mosshammer was 64.
In the wake of last month's devastating tsunami in the Indian Ocean, it should come as no surprise that the annual gay festival in hard-hit Phuket, Thailand, has been rescheduled. This week, organizers announced that the internationally popular Pride Fest, originally set for next month, has been moved to April 7th through 10th. Although some local gay venues have said that others can best support Phuket by going ahead with plans to visit, Pride organizers have agreed that area residents need to focus on the cleanup and emotional recovery. They also recognize that the U.S. and Canadian governments have advised against travel to the region and that some insurers are denying coverage to tourists headed there.
And finally, the U.S. Department of Defense is so convinced of its dogma that homosexuality is incompatible with military service that it once considered its potential as a weapon. The magazine New Scientist reported that the Sunshine Project, a group monitoring chemical and biological weapons research, has now obtained a previously classified 1994 grant proposal from the U.S. Air Force Wright Laboratory that sought $7.5 million to research what it described as harassing, annoying, and bad guy identifying chemicals. Its stated goal was to develop chemicals that affect human behavior so that discipline and morale in enemy units is adversely affected. And it said that one distasteful but completely non-lethal example would be strong aphrodisiacs, especially if the chemical also caused homosexual behavior. The proposal called that imagined weapon a love bomb. The Pentagon confirmed the report of the proposal, but said that none of its ideas had been pursued. Some of the other subjects for the proposed six-year project included a way to simulate flatulence in enemy ranks and a bad guy identifying chemical that would cause severe and lasting halitosis, bad breath.
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 15th, 2005. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres, and you're listening to This Way Out, the Gay and Lesbian International News Magazine.
Thank you.
That was without cue cards, people.
No less a gay pop music icon than the great Sir Elton John has called Rufus Wainwright the greatest songwriter on the planet. Winner of numerous awards and critical acclaim as a solo artist, Rufus is also part of a famous family of folk musicians that tours the world together. When he visits Australia in the next few weeks, he'll be performing both with the group and by himself. In his chat by phone from Montreal, Quebec, with our Brisbane, Queensland correspondent John Frame, Rufus discusses the joys of performing with his family, not compromising on his public identity, and some of the songs on his fourth and brand new CD, Want To, which Rolling Stone magazine says proves that droll commentary and ornate piano orchestrations don't exclude you from being a rock star.
For yourself, though, being born into perhaps a comfortably off and musically talented family, did you feel it was like being born with a silver whistle in your mouth?
We weren't really comfortably off.
Okay.
Unfortunately, yeah. Or actually, fortunately. I mean, my mother did great, did really well, and so did my father in the business. When you really, you know, look at it on a scale. Of what, you know, how most musicians fare usually, but they had to work all the time, and they also had to bring up their children, and I was always very much aware of, you know, the here today gone tomorrow aspect of this business, and was, you know, really educated and you know, the necessity to really be adaptable and you know, to do stuff that the audience will enjoy, which is probably why I'm doing this family tour, because, you know, in my opinion, I mean, there's nothing more pleasing, really, than when, you know, genes kind of sing together, than that sound that's created. So, I don't know, it is a bit of a family business, I guess, and it still needs to be supported.
Absolutely.
So maybe one day we'll be well off.
It seems, too, that you've been, perhaps, exposed to a fair bit of an expectation of celebrity. Like, I saw you, of course, in a particular scene from the Ab Fab special they did in New York,
where
Adina went to look for a gay son, Serge.
Yeah.
And the Advocate, when I looked on the internet for a connection with that, they say that you are there, like scenesters, including Rufus Wainwright. But you don't just become part of a scene like the gay scene. An important thing for our listeners to realize is that you've perhaps always been open and honest about your sexuality.
Yeah, no, I mean, one of the first, in terms of my sexuality, I mean, well, there's two things. One is that when I started my career, the first thing I said to my record company was, and this was even before, I remember it was even before I sat down at the table, I mean, literally sat down, I said, I just want you to know, before we have this meeting, I am not pretending to be straight. I am going to be totally honest about my homosexuality, and there's no way, because I was afraid that, you know, contractually they'd try to bind me into something. Where I'd rather be bound in leather. I'm just kidding. But then, so that was that. And then also, I mean, I have always really been excited by the history of gay culture and you know, and sort of the real sort of tradition of high art and high standards, which you know, has existed for hundreds of years within gay culture. And so I've drawn on that. I felt I was at a tremendous advantage because I could draw from that and you know, carry on that tradition. That has definitely fueled me and helped me. I mean, some people get a little, you know, think, oh, you know, he's too gay or why is he, you know, maybe he's too much of an opera queen or something. But I don't know. I mean, I found it tremendously useful to sort of single myself out.
Sure. Elton John has not been at all reticent in giving his honest opinion of people like George Michael and Madonna lately.
Yeah.
So it must be warming for you to have Elton describe you as the greatest songwriter on the planet at the moment.
I'm very lucky because I actually like him as a person. Mm. If he was some, you know, huge celebrity who you know, had decided to kind of, you know, ingratiate me with his words and his presence, and I didn't like him and I didn't respect him, I'd be kind of screwed, I think, but because in fact he's actually such an amazing guy, and he has been very helpful to me in other areas of my life, mostly to do with, you know, coming to terms with celebrity and mostly, like, just, you know, cutting down on my partying a bit.
Yeah.
He's really, I don't know, he's helped me, like, in other ways too. They're actually far more important than the music business, so that's just an added perk.
Yeah, certainly. From listening to especially the lyrics on Want To, you've made it quite clear that you haven't just been sitting in a room being lonely. And it could have been part of your father sending you to boarding school in New York, but you actually have spent a good part of your 26, 27 years living life to the full.
Yeah, I'm actually 31.
Are you really?
Yeah. Oh. I look 27, but I'm 31.
Uh-huh.
I've lived a full and ripe existence, which is good because, you know, especially these days, I hate to say it, it seems like, you know, the rug could be pulled out from under us any day now, and we're all going to want to live in Australia, just over here in the West, and I would definitely say that, you know, if everything, you know, disappeared tomorrow, I will have led a full and wonderful life.
But that allows you then, lyrically, to say, because the theme for these two albums, Want, is looking at, I would expect, like, needs, desires, aspirations, fantasies. And you can say, well, I've been there and I've done most of that and I know what I'm looking for in life.
Yeah, no, I definitely, you know, I hit 30. I had to, and I think this is true with most men, is that at a certain point, you have to get over the fact that, you know, you're no longer going to be, you know, the picture of Dorian Gray. And that you have to kind of like, you know, decide what you want to do and decide to basically be a man. And it's a tough decision to make, and you do have to make huge sacrifices in order to do it. But in the end, it's really just all about survival and about finding real happiness. And I've made steps towards that anyway. You know, I'm not there yet by far. I still consider myself a child.
I think if people know in the first place that you're a gay man, when they're listening to your songs, they can hear, oh, I know what he's singing about. And there's an ongoing queer reading for those people who want to read it that way.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know, maybe. Do you think there is?
I think there is. And songs like perhaps the single from Want To, the one you love, it's a gender non-specific song except for one little bit of a line.
That song definitely deals with the gay issue, which is, I wouldn't so much say promiscuity, but it is sort of like spreading yourself a little thin and kind of feeling like you've done certain things in your past and with certain people that really kind of have hindered your ability to maintain like a real relationship with someone. I think that's a big problem that a lot of gay people kind of run into at a certain point when, you know, they've done the whole bar thing and they've taken ecstasy and, you know, they've kind of, you know, lived the life of scene and it was fun and glorious and all, but now they want more from life. And well, the song was definitely written at a sort of border area of my life, and I think it sort of expresses that desire.
Song with a straightforward message, including the title Gay Messiah, it does have the potential, I think, to offend people who want to be offended.
I mean that song's interesting to me because it's had three lives already. When I first wrote it, it was essentially a joke song. I mean, it was something to be sung at, you know, cocktail parties and, you know, amongst friends and, you know, or, you know, to sort of liven up an audience and laugh a little. And then when the political climate in the States really, you know, started to reach a fevered pitch, it became a bit of a protest song, and, you know, was always followed by a plea to kind of go out and vote in the next election, you know, because, you know, us gays are kind of in the line of fire here and are not appreciated by the majority of the Republican Party. And then after, unfortunately, the election was lost, the song then became a literal prayer for an actual gay messiah and for some sort of divine intervention. And I do kind of consider it in that weird way, like I do consider it like an actual prayer.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. He will then be reborn from 1970s porn, wearing tube socks with style and such an innocent smile. Better pray for your sins. Better pray for your sins. 'Cause the game of
That was Rufus Wainwright singing Gay Messiah from his new CD, Want To, and in conversation with This Way Out correspondent John Frame in Brisbane, Queensland. Following his performances in Australia, Wainwright will be touring Europe to promote the CD and accompanying DVD. For more information, you can check out his website, rufuswainwright.com. That's RufusWainwright.com. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Rick Watts, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, and John Frame contributed program material, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Thanks also to J.D. Doyle. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. This Way Out is primarily supported by charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. It's you, our listeners, who keep this program on the air, and you can get some queer history and top music and movie reviews on specially produced audio CDs as a bonus. And to be sure you don't miss a week of This Way Out, you can subscribe to high-quality audio cassettes of our program. For all the details, please do log on to thiswayout.org or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WKHS Wharton, Baltimore, Maryland, KMUN Astoria, Oregon, CJLY Nelson, British Columbia, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody's going to stay tuned.